Accession number 28671, Mr. Ronnie Wheatman, Reel 6. Now, so what you formed this radar unit at Branscombe Downs, you've had some military training, and you're getting ready for D-Day.
Yeah.
Now, what was the role of your, what was your unit equipped with?
It was equipped with mobile radar.
Now, tell me what mobile radar is.
Mobile radar consisted of a three-tonner vehicle, two 1,500 vehicles, two jeeps. That's all you were in this unit. Now, your apparatus was mounted on the top of this three-tonner, various aerials that went up that had to be precision in itself. They were all interlocked into various sort of sockets. And the inside of the three-tonner was a receiving unit, which you sat in, and that was it.
Which set was it?
It was a modified CHL.
Okay, so what happens next then?
What happens next? You see, the lead up to D-Day was very, very neatly done. The deployment of troops in the area was tens, hundreds of thousands. The deployment of machines, of aircraft, it was colossal. And when you looked at radar screens and you saw the air literally filled with aircraft, all sort of poised at doing various movements to go in at a certain date. We were told exactly, I think it was 12 hours beforehand, to get your equipment ready and be ready with your vehicles at a certain point to join some convoy system where you would go to Weymouth, and you would be then placed on landing craft and you would go across the channel. That was, we departed on D-Day plus two.
So, on the 8th?
Yeah, D-Day plus two. And we went into the American beachhead.
Now, what do you remember of the channel crossing?
Dreadful. Very, very rough indeed. Very rough indeed. There were countless of us who were very seasick. Very seasick indeed. The noise and din and havoc going around you. You were up on deck because down below was hazardous with the smell of diesel oil that aggravated your tummy more than ever from engines working, from people shouting and yelling. But you just gazed at a scene which was unbelievable, of waves, of ships, of aircraft moving overhead. As you reached this sort of area of the battle where it was going on, because the Americans suffered enormous casualties, you realised that you were in a war zone. And at that moment in time, I think every one of us was extremely frightened. You just were very frightened indeed. Lots of people weed themselves and God knows what else, but you just couldn't help it. Now, our vehicles had to go in. The landing craft were very well made, and they had these big platforms that used to go out, and we rode off on the vehicles. We went into sand dunes, and we were in this.
And this whereabouts exactly had you landed?
God, I can't remember now. The beach was Omar, that's all I can remember.
At Omar?
Yeah. The noise and din, and everything was stinking of cordite. The people, there were hundreds of dead bodies everywhere in bags and sacks, being carefully checked and this, that. But you saw nothing about it. It didn't mean anything to you. The only thing was that you had to go to a certain point, which the commanding officer, flight lieutenant, took us. And we were stable there for about...
So you actually landed on the 8th as
yes,
well?
Yes.
The whole crossing and the thing was all over?
Yeah. And we stopped in this area of huge sand dunes. Now, our gear could not work because we were below the level of the sand dunes. They were enormous sand dunes. So it wouldn't work because the beams you were throwing out, but they were throwing They were going sky high. They weren't catching any object, which was supposed to do. So we stopped there for 10 days, and then the Americans had moved, I think, about a mile or something, because they had a hell of a job to get through the Germans there. And we moved about a mile to a bit of an incline, so then we did operate.
But tell me about the operation, you know, the operation of the equipment.
The operation of the equipment was absolutely splendid. It did work under severe conditions of noise and din and the ground shaking under artillery fire and everything. But it did work splendid. There was no problems regarding it. It was perfect. The manpower is that we as individuals, we sort of, you got that your whole body was immersed in something that was unreal, but you worked what I would call automation. The things you did, you made cups of tea on little sort of small contraptions you had, but you just did it because it was automatic that you did it. It was sort of something which hadn't been instilled into you, but it just came. And we languished there for about 10 days. Now, after 10 days, another crazy thing happened, which I can't believe happened in warfare. The flight lieutenant came to me, he was a Canadian, and he said, I've got here a message through the ministry that you have to return to England. I couldn't believe it. I said, whatever for? They said, well, the thing is, your mother is dying. And I said, but this is war. He said, you've got to go. And he says, these are the orders. And he said, I've got to sign you out, and you've got to go. You'll be escorted with a jeep. The army will take you over, and they will take you back across the channel to Weymouth.
So this was still in June?
This was in June, yes. And so I just said cheerio to the chaps that I knew. They couldn't believe it. They didn't say lucky bugger or anything like that. They just said, well, it's one of those crazy things of war. And off I set. Well, crossing the channel again was dreadful. I was awfully ill, and I went into hospital at Weymouth. Dreadful seasickness. I languished there for, I think it was about 36 hours, and then off I went. But I couldn't go direct home. I had to go to the headquarters that controlled the northwest of England for radar personnel. That was at Boston Spa in Yorkshire. When I went there, I remember I got a hell of a grilling from some flight lieutenant, said, you bloody rotter, you've come out of this lot, you're skiving and all the rest of that. I said, well, I can't help if this is this notice has been sent. And they said, well, the scores of mothers are dying, fathers are dying. Why have you achieved this? I couldn't give him an answer. But I got back. I was posted to Hawcourt, which was Barrow-in-Furness. And my mother...
Hawcourt. It's another radar station.
It's another radar station.
How do you spell it?
H-A-W-C-O-A-T-E. Hawcourt.
And that's Barrow-in-Furness.
That's Barrow-in-Furness. I got there, and of course, they said, well, you've immediately got to go home. So I came home, and my mother was still alive. And the crazy part about all this, my mother lived until she was 95 years old. So.
What was wrong with her? What
well, it was a heart. They said she was dying. I couldn't believe it. I was granted 24 hours. And I thought she would be dead. She wasn't. And then I went back. Well, of course, I couldn't languish at Hawcourt because most of the mails had been sent into the D-Day landings, etc. There was, I think there were three mails and all the rest were WAFs.
And how did you get on with, I mean, did you find it difficult working with so many women? Or
no, no, because you see, in the war, that's what people can't understand these days. If male and female work together now on nights, they'd be skipping in one of those beds. It would be the ongoing thing. Nothing like that occurred. You know, those, it was a different sort of life to what is led now. Everybody revered one another, and that was it. And I languished at Hawcourt, and of course for about, I think it was about 3 weeks, that was all. And
then to July.
Yes. And then I was posted down, back to Boston Spa, down to North Devon, a place called Heartland Point near Biddeford. Heartland Point. Again a CHL station. And again, there was only about 40 males on the station. There were two stations there that that they looked after. The WAFs, as I say, were highly proficient. They looked after you. Now, I was... where are we at now? We're in July, aren't we? July 44. I languished there and then went to a place called Ashburton.
So nothing happened at Heartland?
No, it was just solely plotting masses of aircraft going out to bomb Germany, bomb Europe. There were vast amounts of gliders being taken out, which we had to watch very patiently because they lumbered along at a low speed, and there was always gliders breaking away from the towing rope would break, and they'd have to land in fields, and so there was always going on big problems with the movement, the vast number of aircraft moving. It was then Ashburton, and Ashburton was the headquarters for Southwest of England Radar.
Where is Ashburton?
Ashburton is in Devon. I don't know where the devil and it is now, I just don't know.
So this is near Heartland Point, but somewhere, another one in Devon.
Yes, yeah. But that was the headquarters of Ashburton. I remained there for, say, about 2 months. That brings me up to November. They never moved me back to Germany, back to France. I just languished there. And then I went back to Heartland Point in November, and of course the second front had moved through, and I was expecting to go there. I didn't, and of course I was there for New Year at Heartland Point, and the local village in Devon is a little village called Heartland. They invited all the camp there, and of course they wouldn't, everything was free, so consequently you got bloody drunk, you just did, because of consuming drink of all sorts. When we came back, of course, we were brought back by taxi, we were trundled into some beds and this, that and the other, but the people who had stayed behind to man the sections, there was about 8 of them, they were mostly WAFs, they looked after all those that were in dreadful condition. Now, from there, this is coming up to January 45. At the beginning of January 45, I was sent on a course to hell, just outside London. Staines, near Staines. And it was
what was this course about?
This course was that we had to go on what it was called commando training. I'd done all this countless times through the past years, but you had to go, and you had to learn all about machine guns and this, that, and the other. Well, being in aircrew, a machine gun to me was, I knew all about it. And the instructor, when he said, well, have a go at putting it together, he dismantled it, and he said, I'll show you the bits and pieces. And I picked everything up. And as put it all, he couldn't believe it. He said, well, I've done all this years ago. So, of course, then he said, well, you can take over as assistant instructor. And I got an extra 3 pence a day or something for doing that. But that course was in snow, in frost, and you had no hot water. The huts themselves were dreadful, they were perishing, but the food was absolutely wonderful.
And this is January 45.
This is January 45. I went back to Heartland Point from there, and I was then posted to Morecambe. This was to go abroad. We didn't know where we were going to. We came to Morecambe, and we were there for about 10 days, and then we were all moved. There were thousands who were moved to Blackpool, and from Blackpool, we were geared up to go from there to Glasgow to board a troop ship. And we had no idea till we got on the troop ship until we left England as to where we were going.
Now, when did you leave England then?
Yeah. I left England on February 14th, 1945.
What ship were you on?
I was in the P&O Ranchi.
Ranchi?
Ranchi, Pacific and Orient Ranchi.
Now, what were conditions like on board the Ranchi?
Dreadful. Dreadful, because I should think 80% of the troops on board, I think there were about 2,800 troops and about 400 WAFs and ATS. The sea was dreadful. We didn't eat anything. We were just violently sick. And everything was, conditions were horrible. You couldn't sleep. And I know after about 4 days, I reported to hospital because we'd wrenching so much. You couldn't eat anything in your stomach. And the pain was dreadful.
How bad was it? I mean, you've mentioned seasickness before. It was obviously something that got you worse than most.
No, they were all the same. There was only about 10 of the 2,000 that weren't seasick. And this with masses of people being sick all over the damn place. And you had to clean it up, which made it worse than ever. You had brushes and you had buckets. And, God, it was so foul, it was horrible. You never saw the WAFs. Now, this went on. We went right in. It was a huge convoy. I think there were about 6 troop ships we picked up. There were a tremendous amount of destroyers around us and cruisers. And we altered the course many, many times. But right out in the Atlantic. Then we came past the Azores. And we were told that they were the Azores, etc. And then we headed for the intake into the Mediterranean. As we approached Gibraltar, the sky started to clear. And I'd never eaten for about 8 days, and I found in my pocket a piece of bread that was as hard as iron, and I just ate that bread. It to me was, oh my God, you were starving. Through the Mediterranean into the Red Sea, and of course then we were given change of clothing from the rough clothing that we had to keep us warm to shorts and short sleeve things, and we got through the Mediterranean, through the Suez Canal. One thing happened, we got stuck with this huge liner. It ran aground, so we had to stop there for about 12 hours, and we were there overnight. Now, during the day, the heat is unbearable, but at night time, it wham, goes down dead cold. We were all up on deck. We had to shift, because it was perishing. We went through the Red Sea, and we arrived at Bombay.
That was where you're going?
Yeah, Bombay.
And what were your first impressions of Bombay?
First impressions of Bombay were when we moved into the quayside, and you saw the masses and masses of people, some of them dressed in rags really, but all there at the dockside waiting to carry whatever articles we allowed them to carry from there to 3 tonners, which were taking us to a transit place. Now, these people, to us, looked dreadful because they were thin and they just carried our kit bags on the heads and we were told to give them a small amount. I think it was 2 annas or something, and we couldn't believe it because 2 annas was nothing. And we, you know, everybody gave them a large amount of money. The NCOs played hell. They say, no, don't give them that because it's all a con. They don't take that money themselves. They give it to someone who's in charge of them, and he doles out a very minute amount. We got to the place where we're going to, which is a huge transit camp.
And which one? Do you know?
It's called Worli. W-O-R-L-I, Worli. It's on the outskirts of Bombay. Massive place. The food we found after being on a boat, and it took us just 28 days from Glasgow to Bombay.
So you got there in March?
Yeah, March 14th. And the food that we got there, we couldn't believe it, because you had fresh fruit. You were able to go into cafes, and you could get bacon and eggs and all the rest of it, which were unheard of to us. And it was all very cheap. So it was like coming from something where it was austere to one where there was bags of food. But the people themselves were destitute. They were in rags and tatters, and because your beggars had to see you night and day for doanas, and this doanas were 2 annas, of course, and clutching you for food and this and the other. From there, I was there for 8 days. I went to Pune. Now
was it you, or were you an individual draft?
No,
or a unit?
No. I think there was about 40 of us. We're going to a place called Belgaum, which is south of Pune. It's a transit place for radar personnel. But the journey from Bombay to Pune is very spectacular. It goes through a mountain range called the Western Ghats. The train was double-headed, and it was called the Deccan Queen. But it was packed, literally packed and packed, inside and outside, with masses of people. Everybody seems in India moves on the trains. And of course, they go very slow. There are tremendous inclines, but it's a mass of people moving. Now, the coaches that we had were allocated just to white people. They were very Spartan. They just were like, you sat on not anything with any comfort. There were just slots of wood. And at the first night that there was, because you were on it for 2 days, there was an army sergeant who was in with us. And when it got to about 5:45, he dug out his torch. And he says, that's the most important thing tonight, the torch. And we said, whatever for? Oh, he said, that'll be on all night. And because we said, why the hell? He said, well, that's the only way you can combat the blasted cockroaches. Everything was infested with cockroaches, and they came out in the dark. And
the whole train?
The whole train. And, of course, he put this on, and we said, well, there's no cockroaches about. Where are they? He said, right. He said, I'll put this off for 1/4 hour and just see what happens. And he'd put it off. We're in darkness, the noise and bedlam going through various trees and tunnels. But then he put it on. And the walls, there was hundreds and hundreds of them, all in black and white, evil-looking things. They look foul. And of course, the moment the light went on, they all scurried back to the corners. But that was one thing that I still remember. We got to Pune. We had to change engines there because the track is a different width. And we waited there about 12 hours. Sat on the station, personally went to canteens and drank tea and ate sandwiches. Now, Pune in itself is just a military place. It was very professional. The soldiers were all spick and span. The inside of Pune is out of bounds to all troops. It was then because of masses of brothels and this, that and the other. But we had a wander around to have a look. We were all what you would call sprogs from England. We were all white. And of course, those chaps that had been out there some time, they used to shout all sorts at us, white legs and God knows what. But we went from there to Belgaum. Now, Belgaum was another, it was a walled city, and it was out of bounds to troops. But the place at Belgaum, where we were at, was out in the country, and it was, I think it was about 1,000 feet up.
So you know its name, or was it?
It was just called Belgaum, B-A-L-G-U-A-M, Belgaum. And it was very large, and it was, you were in accommodation that there were three to a room, and you had bearers to look after you, and then you did training on mobile radar.
Now tell me about the conditions a bit. What sort of room were you in? Was it any different from an English hut, a British hut?
Oh yes, totally different. Very Spartan. You only had a bed, which was a bed that was made, it was called a charpoy, which was all, it hadn't got a mattress. It just had throngs of this rattan stuff interlocked all the way along to make sort of that you could lie on it. Now, you carried with you, wherever you went in India, you carried two blankets, two sheets rolled up, which was your personal possessions. It was given to you, which you had to carry. Well, you didn't carry it because the Indians were always there to carry it for you, and they got money, etc. But this was all you had. There wasn't anything to put anything else on. You utilised your kit bag for putting your worldly possessions on.
And what was the food like?
The food was excellent. Your food was plenty. Fresh fruit, and any amount of food.
Was it English style or Indian style?
No, it was English style. There was perhaps once a fortnight you had curry laid on if you wanted it. Well, those that had been in India some time, you got to liking curry. The people who had just come out from England, you didn't have curry, because it was unheard of. Nobody had curry in those days. You did get accustomed to it, and I know I got a great liking for it. But at Belgaum, we did a vast amount of going out in the country and getting ourselves organised, because we realised that we were going to go into Burma or some other place.
Now, what type of mobile radar training were you doing at Belgaum?
Now, the type of radar we had there was mounted on a 1500 weight, and it was called, its code name was GOAT, G-O-A-T. Now, the reception from it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It really was good, and it did work.
And this is a different type of set, the GOAT.
Another
set.
Different set, yes. It was what they call Type 64, and it was mobile. In this unit that you were set up in, there were 22 of us. That included MT drivers, cooks, and one military police, a commanding officer, flight lieutenant, two sergeants, and the rest were either operators or mechanics.
Again, you don't remember the number?
No, I can't remember the number at all.